The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions? Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Good morning in North America and good afternoon in Great Britain and Europe. I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. British Standard Time. With my guests here on Voice America, I look at emerging and frontier markets investing. We aim to clarify what's happening in these markets and provide the information you need to make your investment decisions. We look at what works in these markets right now and what my guests and I believe will work there in the future. I spent most of my professional career analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money. I believe I can spot the differences between promising investments and ones that may prove to be less promising. But you don't just have to take my word for it. Each week I'll talk to Wall Street veterans, fund managers, analysts, and journalists about emerging and frontier markets. We'll have reports from guests familiar with the economies and investments in these countries, sometimes on the ground there. In fact, for some investors familiar with investing in emerging economies, frontier markets are a logical next step. By emerging markets, we obviously mean the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And today, I'll be looking at Brazil. In the emerging markets category, we'd also include markets such as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. By frontier markets, we mean the emerging markets. Countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovakia, and Botswana. Today, I'll have reports directly from Kazakhstan, Nigeria, and Slovakia. Our game plan is to provide you with the information you need about emerging market investments and frontier market investments. As an indicator of what is happening in this space, several new frontier market funds have been launched in the months since we decided to launch this program. We had a bit of emerging markets history this week. Jim O'Neill, chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management, which manages over $740 billion in assets, issued his last research note 2 days ago. Many will also know that O'Neill coined the BRICS acronym to describe Brazil, Russia, India, and China. As I mentioned later in the program, I'll be looking at Brazil. O'Neill also coined the phrase N11, or Next 11, a group of countries he believed held great promise and that could possibly become the next generation of BRIC markets. Amongst them, he included South Korea, Mexico, the Philippines, and Nigeria, and we'll have a report from Nigeria later in the program. In his last note, O'Neill opens by saying, "For my last viewpoint, I've chosen to focus on the world," and then proceeds to do just that. He makes the point that the contribution to growth in the last decade from 2000 to 2010 from the four BRIC nations, along with the four biggest next 11 markets that each represent at least 1% of global GDP, was bigger than the aggregate for the G7 in 2010 dollar terms. To go further into this and other emerging markets, I have Wall Street veteran James Awad on the line. James is chairman of Plimsollmark Capital, a division of Zephyr Management LP in New York. The two companies have about $750 million in assets under management. James is also a contributor to the book my co-author Al Emmett and I have just completed on frontier markets. Hello, James, and welcome.
Good morning.
Talking about Mr. O'Neill's last research note, he's fairly bold, which I suppose you can be if it's your last note, in setting the scene for what might happen in the world as far as economic growth is concerned for the next decade, and it covers most economies. Would you like to comment, because I know you've had a chance to at least look at his initial conclusions in that note, about his thinking on BRICS in the next 11?
Yeah, I agree with his analysis, which is that is the center of economic growth in the world, that they have been contributing increasing amounts of the world's growth, that is likely to continue, primarily because of the emerging middle class in many of those geographies. So he is bullish on equities in general, and particularly bullish on the BRICS and the next 11. And I agree with that, but having made that general statement, then you then have to go to geographies in particular in terms of executing your investment strategy rather than just in blanket fashion buying all of the geographies.
Well, talking about more specific geographies, I believe that Mr. O'Neill said that if China can continue to grow at 7.5% this decade, then the rest of the world can grow by 4%. I imagine that would be something of a rebuttal to all of the doubters in terms of China being able to maintain that rate of growth. Do you feel that those people who are a little skeptical about China do have a case, but would you at the same time feel that the possibility of China continuing to maintain 7.5% growth is a possibility?
Yes, if you put a gun to my head and said, are they going to do it, or is this really a credit bubble? I would say that it's more likely to be real growth, sustainable growth. They do have hurdles they have to come over. They have to make the move from an investment economy and an export economy to a consumption economy. They have to do that to keep the growth and to keep the political system intact, because they are able to get away with reduced political freedom by virtue of giving people increasing amounts of economic freedom. So it's not a slam dunk that they can pull it off, but you have to say their record so far is pretty good. The wealth is accumulating there. It is incrementally being spent. And I think while it's not a riskless trade, that the odds are that the Chinese will be able to grow at that level, make a contribution to growth in that entire region, and also help get the 4% type of global growth that Mr. O'Neill is expecting.
Now, we've been seeing, after several years of outflows, increased interest in emerging market mutual funds over the last 9-12 months. What particular factors do you feel are driving that renewed interest on the part of developed market investors in emerging markets?
Well, two things. First is that because of the easy money of the central banks around the world, the risk appetite in the financial markets has increased. People are looking for return in a almost no return fixed income environment. And emerging markets have to be a piece of that complex, if you will. And secondly, over this year, calendar 2013, the developed markets, led by the U.S., have outperformed the emerging markets in terms of appreciation. So there is a school of thought that says that if world growth is going to continue, if the financial markets are going to continue to appreciate, then the long-term growth being greater in the emerging markets, and they're having underperformed this year to date, that on a shorter-term basis, that may be where the relative value is. And so you're seeing increasing amounts of money allocated there.
So moving from the one that's done better to the one that's done worse.
Yes, that although emerging markets have done better over time, the U.S. has really led the pack in many ways, both economically and financially this year. And so that with emerging markets unchanged for the year and the S&P up double digits, that the relative shorter term value would be over in the emerging markets.
And looking at the type of investors who are buying emerging market funds, is there any great difference between what retail investors are buying and what longer-term investors, or supposedly longer-term investors like pension plans and private foundations, are doing?
Yeah, no, I don't think at this point there is a difference. If you got to the point where the emerging markets were smoking, if you will, as they were in 2007, you know, at that point you typically get extraordinary retail flows, but that's not the case here. The flows seem to be balanced among institutional and individual investors.
Which is obviously healthy in that when you get retail interest at a high level, it does tend to be a bit of a contrarian indicator, I think. Yes. It's fair to say. How long should an investor, whether it's an individual or a pension plan, be looking to leave their money in emerging or frontier markets investments? What would you feel from your experience, James, would be an appropriate sort of timescale to look at?
Yeah, you shouldn't invest in the area unless you have a 5-year time horizon, because there are periods of euphoria and depression in emerging markets. They're almost, in many cases, in the financial markets, sometimes a leveraged play on the risk on, risk off trade, although that has not been the case this year. So you don't want to get caught in the short term volatility, have to sell when you don't want to sell. And so I would say you need to have a 5-year time horizon, and the younger you are, the more of your money you should have allocated to that area, because you have a situation where the consumers are not levered like developed country consumers, where the governments aren't levered like developed country governments, and so the ingredients for higher, longer term growth are there for the emerging markets. So the younger you are, the more you should have there, because that's where the growth is going to be.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you say that, James, as my children's education plan actually have quite a big exposure in emerging and frontier markets investing, because obviously they do have the longest time horizon. Without obviously asking you the unknowable question in terms of your outlook for the short-term moves in markets, what would you think is the likely outlook for the next, say, year to 18 months, given the relative underperformance of emerging markets against developed markets over the last year or so?
Yeah, it looks to me like the world you see is the world you're going to get, unless we get a geopolitical accident or a financial accident in Europe. Absent that happening, it looks to me like you're looking at 2% growth in the United States, 0 in Europe, 7 plus in China, 5 plus in India. Low inflation, low interest rates, and that environment should lead to continued gradual increases in stock prices worldwide, punctuated by volatility. But in that environment, given that the emerging markets have lagged, one could make the case they should start to outperform over the next 12 months to make up the underperformance they've had year to date.
Well, that's an encouraging outlook, James. Thanks very much indeed, and I hope we'll be able to come back and touch base with you in the not-too-distant future to see how things are working out.
My honor and pleasure.
Thanks. That was James Awad, Chairman of Plimsoll Mark Capital, a division of Zephyr Management LP in New York. After the break, I'll be checking out one of the BRICS, that's Brazil, but first we'll have a report from Nigeria.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on Frontier Markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm Gavin Graham. Nigeria is one of the more promising of the frontier markets, and I have Nigerian correspondent Samuel Okoa on the line from Lagos for a report on the Nigerian oil industry and its impact on the economy. Samuel says that with proper management, oil revenues could help close the infrastructure deficit there, leading to increased investment opportunities in Africa's most populous country and perhaps to greater investment comfort with investing in the country. Hello over there in Lagos, Samuel.
Hello, this is Samuel Okocha, live from Lagos, Nigeria.
Thanks very much for joining us here on Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, Samuel. I mentioned in the introduction the possibility that oil revenues could help close the infrastructure deficit in Nigeria. I believe that, and most observers believe, that it's quite a large infrastructure deficit. Obviously, that presumably has hampered the development of the Nigerian economy.
That's true.
And it's fairly widespread in what, power and telecoms and transport?
Can you tell me again, please?
I'm sorry, I was saying that the infrastructure deficits have been over a number of sectors, including power, telecoms, and transport. Would that be an accurate statement?
Absolutely. Yes, especially in the power sector, the deficit is so huge that a lot of manufacturing companies are actually closed to shop as a result of that. For instance, the textile industry that used to be a huge employer of labor has closed over the years, and that has led to a lot of unemployment. We also have a case of a company, Dunlop Nigeria, that manufactures tire locally. It has stopped doing that, rather like imports tires into the country. So these are some of the infrastructural deficit, especially with regard to inefficient power supply in Nigeria.
So the oil industry continues to be Nigeria's top foreign exchange earner by far, and it's obviously dominated by multinationals like Royal Dutch Shell. Are there other companies apart from Shell which are major players in the Nigerian oil industry?
Yes, aside from Shell, of course, we have American companies. We have Chevron. It's a major player in the Nigerian oil industry.
And the foreign exchange that's been earned from all of these oil revenues, obviously a fair amount has been misappropriated. And as you already mentioned, the infrastructure deficit. But is there now some developments that give hope that that more of the revenues generated by the oil earnings will actually be spent within the country on productive investment?
Yeah, absolutely. The consciousness of Nigerians continue to rise. Just last year, we had the massive, what they called Occupy Nigeria. It was inspired as a result of the seeming lack of transparency in the oil industry. And so that protest has led to lots of a probe into the industry. And what that means is that there is this level of consciousness that monies from the oil sector must be put into use and develop infrastructure in Nigeria. So from that standpoint, it is hoped that the government and leadership will devise means of ensuring that monies are properly used. And so that should spur a development and close the infrastructure deficit we do have currently in Nigeria.
And with that attempt to get more transparency into the oil sector, at the same time, what has there been any changes in terms of the attitude towards foreign investment, foreign direct investment as well?
Yes, actually, the government has always been open to foreign direct investment. And at every opportunity, you see government officials trying to woo foreign investors. So in terms of the climate for foreign investment remains very favorable. However, the situation on the ground will raise concerns for many investors, especially with regards to the deficit I mentioned, like power and the rest. However, having said that, foreign direct investment in Nigeria is a very, very, it's a complex mix of, government, wind, foreign investors, and the reality on the ground. Now, the reality on the ground is that Nigerians are used to the current infrastructural deficits. And that means we have higher cost of goods and services. Well, that means foreign investors will factor that into whatever their program is in Nigeria. And, of course, they'll have to pass that to the consumer. However, if the infrastructural deficit is closed, we could have more foreign investment, not just from the Western countries, but from within the African continent, coming into Nigeria and taking advantage of the huge population we have, the huge market we have, and make things happen.
Well, Samuel, that's an optimistic way to finish this segment on Nigeria. Thank you very much indeed for your input. And in the weeks to come, I hope to be talking to you about some of the other African frontier markets and the opportunity of for potential investors in those as well. Thanks very much indeed, Samuel.
Thank you so very much. The pleasure is mine.
Thanks. Our next report comes to us from Paris. I have Bill Hinchberger on the line from Paris. That's Paris in France rather than Paris, Texas. He covered Brazil for many years for publications such as the Financial Times and now lectures on Brazil at the Sorbonne University. His work as a journalist covering Brazil attracted titles such as The Brazil Guy and The Most Brazilian of Foreign Correspondents. So who better to talk to us about Brazil than Bill Hinchberger? Good afternoon, Bill, and thanks very much for being on the program.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Earlier in the program, we talked briefly about Jim O'Neill at Goldman Sachs and his last report, and we have O'Neill to thank for the phase BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, for the four major emerging markets. If I understand your columns correctly, you have a sort of good news, bad news view on Brazil. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, that's a fair analysis. I mean, I am not caught up in the euphoria, haven't been caught up in the euphoria of the last few years, which I think is a little bit misplaced, because I think Brazil really missed an opportunity to move forward in a lot of areas over the last decade. And I think that's going to, in terms of things that they call the Brazil cause, which relate to infrastructure, taxation, a lot of other things, which make it much more expensive to do business in Brazil than most anywhere else in the world. On the other hand, that said, in the context of, you know, working in Brazil, if you're a foreign company or a multinational company, even a Brazilian company, Brazilians want to buy things. It's a big market. Companies in multinationals have always done well in Brazil, even through the periods of hyperinflation and military dictatorships and everything else. So, it's a question of not getting too caught up in the short term if you're looking at Brazil as an investor.
So on the good news side, we have the 2014 Soccer World Cup next year and the 2016 Summer Olympic Games. Obviously, that's likely to produce a major boost for the economy.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the thing is that there's again, it's just kind of a mixed reaction thing. I mean, they just reinaugurated Maracanã, which is the big
soccer stadium. That's right.
Soccer,
yeah.
Stadium in Rio, but they reinaugurated it in it's still a construction site. I mean, they were supposed to do that a few months ago, and they've got this Confederations Cup coming up in June, which is a 2 years before the World Cup. They have this tournament, and it's kind of like a dry run for the World Cup. But only four of the stadiums that they plan to have in the World Cup are ready for this Confederations Cup. So that these things should engender investment and all that kind of stuff, but the investment's lagging behind. It does generate, interest in the country, like you see that happen in South Africa with the World Cup or in London or everywhere else the Olympics are at. There's always, the eyes of the world are on that country. And that generates, a certain amount of goodwill and generates tourism and generates some other things. But I think that Brazil, is in, you'll see even some of the people, Romário, who's a former, football player, is now a member of Congress and is very critical about the way the World Cup, preparations are going on. So, it's kind of a good thing on one hand, but then on the other hand, it's showing some of the weaknesses of the country.
And as far as that should, although obviously there'll be delays and late completion as there were with other major activities in developing markets like the South African World Cup, but it's still generally going to be a boost. On the other side, the exposure that Brazil has to China and its demand for commodities has been acting as a bit of a drag on growth over the last year and a half. Would that be correct to say?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it all on the commodities and on China. I think that the problem is probably, for Brazil's problem, is probably more internal in the way that they've used they've sold, the commodities, especially mining, minerals and soybeans and whatnot, to China, and then gotten all this cash back, and essentially they just spent it on consumption. You know, you could say that's not a bad thing in a country that's so poor as Brazil, but they haven't spent it on investment, and they aren't you know, big savers, and the savings rate is low. So basically, you just have all this cash coming in, but you're not getting long-term benefits really from it. You're getting a certain amount of short-term benefits on the retail side, but you know, that's even slowing down now. In February, we saw some, for the first time in many months, years really, a dip in retail sales, which is a concern because that's really the only thing besides these commodity sales that's been keeping things going recently.
So just to wind things up, Bill, balancing up the boost from the potential boost from the World Cup and from the Summer Olympics with the slowdown that the commodity prices have been causing, what would you say the outlook for Brazil through the remainder of this year is in terms of growth and inflation?
Well, inflation is starting to become a problem, but I mean, it's not historically, I mean, the 6.5 or 7% that you're talking about is nothing compared to the hyperinflation we saw a couple decades ago. So they'll probably be able to keep that under control. The growth rates, everybody's got a low, for the BRICS anyway, or for emerging markets, Brazil's going to be on the low end, the laggard behind the other countries of the group, I think, in terms of growth. You also have to note that there's elections coming up in 2014, and election years are always complicated in terms of trying to get anything done in political reforms or anything like that, that need to happen really to sort of free up some of the economy. So I would say, you know, the next year or so is mostly muddling through. You know, if you're an investor, you can find some opportunities in the country.
Well, that's a useful summary. Thank you, Bill. And appreciate you being on the show. Hope to be back to see how things are working out as we get closer to the World Cup.
Okay, Gavin. Thank you.
Thanks to Bill Hinchberger and Pallas for clearing up some of our questions about Brazil. When I come back after the break, I'll have a report from Kazakhstan about the government's campaign about against corruption there. It's one of their initiatives to attract Western investment.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. This is Gavin Graham with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. Several of what we know as frontier markets are former Soviet bloc countries now making the transition to market economies. We wanted to check in on Kazakhstan for several reasons, including its ranking in third place in the Business Insider list of 25 most promising frontier markets for investors. More about that list later. Kazakh authorities see reducing corruption not only as an end in itself, but as a means of increasing the country's attractiveness to foreign investors. I have Anvar Sadinov on the line from Almaty, Kazakhstan. He's a former government official and now an independent director at a bank there. Welcome to the program, Anvar.
Hello.
Thanks very much for being with us. Before we get to the campaign against corruption, the Kazakh government recently hired former British PM Tony Blair's company, to help raise Kazakhstan's image. What will that do for Kazakhstan?
There is not much information, I mean, for the general public what Tony Blair and his company are advising on. I know that from the general information that they are working with the top officials and the president of Kazakhstan since spring of 2011. And their advice are given in a wide range of areas, including corporate governance, transparency of authorities at high and local level, streamlining the procedures of the public procurement. So that's it. And I think in general, such advice could be use to Kazakhstan authorities.
So a fairly wide-ranging mandate. But now let's address the issue of corruption. I know that the Kazakhstan government takes eradicating corruption very seriously. Can you give us a picture of where it is now and where the government hopes to go?
Yes, I think right now in the agenda of the government, this fight against corruption is rather high. There is a special five-year state program of fighting corruption, which was adopted in 2011 for a five-year period. There is a number of laws right now being discussed in the parliament, and they are going to be adopted to fight corruption. I think that's a problem which could not be overcome quite easily. They have different layers, at local layers, in different state agencies. Issue is quite different. Of course, nobody could be immune against corruption, but I think, for example, in the financial regulation sector, if you look at the national or central bank, this issue is not so acute as it is, say, at the tax or customs authorities. We should look at some maybe international rankings, and the most known is the Transparency International Index.
And so,
yes. So please have some. Right.
Excellent. So some measures are already being taken. Supposing that everything works out as planned, what does the government hope to achieve? For example, you mentioned the Transparency International rankings. Would it be a substantial improvement in those in terms of the way that Kazakhstan is perceived?
I think yes. To keep for example, the figures again about these rankings for the 2012 ranking, Kazakhstan is 133rd among 176 countries, together with Russia and Iran, for example. But there is a target that by the end of this program in 2015, we should reach ranking 90 in this league. So it's quite an ambitious task. In terms of investors, I think things are much better, especially if you talk about foreign investors. There is another ranking which is prepared by World Bank and IFC, World Bank Group. It's called Ease of Doing Business. And for Kazakhstan, for the last overall Ease of Doing Business rank, we are number 49 among 185 countries, economies.
So in other words,
our achievements are much higher. And if you look at public rankings, for example, protection of investors' rights, we are at number 10 in this list for the last year. I think from that point of view, the foreign investor rights are quite...
So in other words, for foreign investors particularly, the situation is already quite attractive in terms of Kazakhstan's ranking, but at the same time, the government is determined to raise overall rankings in terms of the perception of corruption by making some very specific measures as far as local and regional governments, as well as at the central government level.
I think right. Of course, for foreign investors, there are some different channels or institutions of their protection. For example, the one which was established in 1998, the Foreign Investors Council, where major investors are represented and they have direct access to the top officials, including President of Kazakhstan, who is the co-chair of this council, together with the President of the EBRD. There are some like bilateral institutions like American Chamber of Commerce in Kazakhstan or European Eurobank, which is European business community, which is supported by the EU Commission. So I think all these institutions, and most of them are NGOs, could help foreign investors to find the ways and areas of in Kazakhstan and then to protect their rights.
Well, Anvar, thanks very much indeed for updating us on the what's happening in terms of the Kazakhstan government's efforts in the area of corruption and the fact that foreign investors already have various means of gaining access at the highest level if they do have concerns. Thanks very much indeed.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Anvar Saidanov in Almaty, Kazakhstan. And next up, we have Lucas Kawa to talk about emerging and frontier markets and the list of the 25 best frontier markets for investors. We're just waiting to have him on the line, but Lucas researched the list for Business Insider magazine, basing it on information contained in the Bloomberg Markets magazine article entitled The BRICS New Facade by Bloomberg journalist Michael Patterson. Lucas, thanks very much for being with us here.
It's great to be here, Gavin. Thanks for having me.
So you have the list of the 25 best frontier markets, and given the changing and rapidly changing nature of the frontier market scene, it might seem a little risky to assemble such a list.
Well, certainly that's the case, but I think Michael Patterson and his team at Bloomberg did a great job, and they were pretty thorough in researching and evaluating these investment opportunities. You know, they based it on a variety of metrics, including IMF growth forecasts, ease of doing business rank, government debt, the age of the population, and so on, and gave them an overall score based on those metrics. But that being said, there may be some important criteria that were not included, and I feel that there's a couple countries on the list that perhaps won't be cracking this list next year.
Which might surprise many that Vietnam came in top of the list as number one.
Well, it might surprise some, but Vietnam also topped the list the previous year. And inflation remains a bit of a sore spot for Vietnam, but based on P/E ratios, their equities appear to be very attractively priced. They also offer a high dividend yield. And the Vietnamese economic narrative, it bears a lot of similarities to the Chinese narrative in the past, where China enjoyed export-led growth that was carried out by low labor costs. And we've seen manufacturing shift away from China in favor of locales with even lower labor costs, and that includes places like Vietnam.
Right. Following Vietnam, Estonia, which is obviously a fairly small market and which doesn't feature on many people's radar screens in terms of frontier markets, was number two.
Yeah, sometimes it's so small you forget that it's part of the EU and it's in there, but of all the countries that were featured on Bloomberg's list, Estonia actually had the best ranking for ease of doing business. And there are another place like Vietnam that they benefit from the competitive advantage of low labor costs. Labor in Estonia is about one-third of the EU average, and it's also a hotbed for Swedish companies, a lot of Swedish banks in Estonia, as well as Ericsson has a pretty large manufacturing base there. And you know, Paul Krugman would disagree, but Estonia is often looked to as the poster child for austerity in the sense that it implemented cuts following the financial crisis and then had a pretty substantial rebound in growth. But that being said, GDP still hasn't returned to its 2007 levels.
Now, that seems to be a feature of small Nordic economies, Iceland, obviously featuring in that same list. The market where we were just speaking to Anwar Saidenov, Kazakhstan, is in third place, which probably would not rank as highly as Estonia in terms of a number of rankings, but at the same time, it still comes in number three.
Yes, and, you know, I'll extol the virtues of the Kazakhstan economy. It attracts a lot of foreign direct investment. Kazakhstan's rich in natural resources. In fact, it's the world's leading producer of uranium, and a lot of that goes to China, but there's also... Yep. significant reserves of oil, natural gas, rare earth elements, and they've got a bright workforce. The literacy yep. rate is approaching 100%, and they're looking to diversify and develop a bit of a green economy. So although they're susceptible to oil price shocks, and you know the major index is down about 2% on the year, Kazakhstan, it looks to be a great place for growth in the future.
So the strength of some of these frontier markets and their GDP growth could easily overshadow the BRICS over the next couple of years, especially given some of the issues they've been having, as we were hearing about in the feature on Brazil.
Yes, it's 2012 was the Bloomberg article mentioned that 2012 was the third year that stocks in the BRIC nations underperformed relative to the global markets, and China was the worst of these. And they're not off to a great start this year either. You know, the Shanghai index is down about 4% year to date. Brazil's major index is down over 8%. Russian equity is down about 5%, and India is more or less flat on the year. And you had a guest last week that I wouldn't go as far as he did in
terms of his views on China, but at the same time, obviously there are some major concerns there.
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as your guest last week in doubting the Chinese economic statistics, but it's definitely a lack of trust, in a sense, that holds some of these markets back, especially China and Russia, and especially in the case of China, accounting procedures that I think it really keeps investors from dedicating a lot of money and putting inflows into those markets because you can't necessarily trust how the accounting procedures are handled.
So to wind up this conversation, Lucas, was political stability taken into account in this work?
Ironic that, you know, that's definitely one of the metrics that I would have thought should be included, but it wasn't. I think the closest you could get to that was they included the Corruption Perceptions Index and
right.
Government debt to GDP, but, you know, political stability was not taken into account. But we know that political stability is perhaps the most important point for investors to consider when evaluating opportunities in these markets, and not only in frontier markets, but also you've seen political instability in Italy, where they have yep. a undecided election cause bond yields to spike. And, you know, in the example of Egypt, where, you know, stocks have crashed since the Arab Spring, and they are beginning to recover, but political stability is definitely something that, you know, investors should be taking note of when evaluating these opportunities.
No, I think you're absolutely correct, Luke. It's a very important point and somewhat surprising that it wasn't included. Thanks very much indeed, and hope to touch base with you again to continue this discussion, because obviously there's a lot more countries on that list of 25 that are worth talking about.
Agreed, Gavin. Good luck with the rest of the show.
Thanks so much. I've been talking to Lucas Kawa about the list of 25 best frontier markets for investors. We got a near-term view of the future of frontier markets in the process. After the break, I'll go to another frontier market and talk to European correspondent Mario Marcinek.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750. You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Slovakia is one of the countries that ranks high on many lists of promising frontier markets. Since the breakup of the USSR, its control over Eastern Europe, it's been making the transition from an old-style Soviet bloc country to a more modern-day market economy and experiencing a few difficulties along the way. I have European correspondent Mario Marcinek on the line from Bratislava to bring us up to date on what's happening in Slovakia. Thanks very much for joining us today, Mario. So, since the breakup of the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia effectively gaining its freedom in 1989, please bring us up to date on the developments that led to Slovakia becoming independent.
Well, after the breakup of the Eastern Bloc and after the so-called Velvet Revolution, it took only 4 years to the former Czechoslovakia to peacefully split into two countries in 1993, which created the independent Czech Republic and Slovak Republic as well.
So that was a fairly peaceful transition?
Yes, it was peaceful. Economically speaking, it was much more complicated with the massive privatization of the economy and every, we could say, child diseases that go with it.
And effectively, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Mario, Slovakia did a sort of voucher-style, Soviet-style privatization, and that ended up with a few people getting fairly rich, but most people not getting a great deal, if anything at all.
Yes, Gavin, you are correct. This was also the part of the transition process, which some observers were to believe was slowed down in the years 1994 to 1998 period due to the crony capitalism and other fiscal policies of the former Prime Minister Vladimir Mečiar's government. While the economic growth in that era and the other fundamentals improved steadily during the Mečiar's term, public and private debt and the trade deficits also rose, and the privatization was uneven. Real annual GDP growth peaked at 6.5% in 1995, but declined to 1.3% in 1999.
And then there was a period when the government placed a priority on stabilization. Can you tell us about that?
Two governments of the liberal conservative prime minister Nicolas Zurinda followed in years 1998 to 2006. And these two governments were pursuing the policies of macroeconomic stabilization and market-oriented structural reforms. Since then, nearly the entire economy has been privatized, and the foreign investment has picked up. Economic growth exceeded expectations in the early 2000s, despite recession in the key export markets. For instance, in the year 2010, GDP per capita at purchasing power parity was around 19,000 euros, which is about $20,000, and it was 74% of the European Union average.
Did getting into NATO and the European Union help the transformation along?
Yes, it certainly did. Not only it allowed us to be accepted in the club of the stable countries, but it proved that Slovakia can be a reliable partner in both business and in security in this region. We were accepted to NATO and into the European Union in 2004. In fact, today is the anniversary of our entrance to the European Union. And Slovakia also accepted euro currency in the year 2009. During these years, rightist and leftist governments were at the helm, each promoting their own views on economy and investment opportunities. Generally speaking, the rightist government, led by Minister Mikulas Zurinda and later by Zeta Radičová, promoted open economy with lower taxes, even accepting the flat tax rate of 19%. On the other hand, the leftist government of Prime Minister Fico promoted a stronger state position and stronger control over the economy.
So, Mario, having to wind it up now as we're getting close to the end of the program, but what briefly would you say are the strengths of the Slovak economy that would appeal to investors?
Definitely the cheap labor and relatively weak labor code compared with the high-skilled and the highly educated labor force would be appealing. Also, despite the flat tax rate of 19% was abolished last year, the corporate income tax is still 23%, which is lower than the other countries in the European Union. There are many industrial parks ready for the investors to come, and government also promotes the investment stimuli or incentives. Which are given in the form of tax relief and are given to the investors who create new jobs and bring in new innovations. So this might also be something worth looking into.
Well, that's great. Thanks very much indeed, Mario, and I'm glad we were able to connect. Thanks for being with me today.
Bye.
In our next edition of Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, I'll talk to someone, Peter Merrick, about the effect of demographics on these markets. We'll have a look at emerging market mutual funds with Morningstar analyst Patricia Wee, and we'll be talking to retirement planning specialist Darren Velado. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We're the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is scheduled for release by John Wiley & Sons in late summer of this year, another book on frontier markets set for release before the end of the year. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter. For more information, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks, and please join us next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.